Okay, welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 12. Now, just a warning, we are going to start experimenting with turning all of these things into a podcast. So, if anybody would like to fill their device up with podcasts of our lectures, may we suggest you seek some professional help. But if you're still bent on trying that, we will let everybody know when the podcast feed goes live, and you can all try podcasting your lectures down, which I think will be convenient if you've got an iThing or similar, so that you can get your lecture audio when it comes out, and you can just tell it to check things, and it will pick up the new episode. Alrighty. Anybody got any queries, questions? I'm not seeing much of the Chapter 2 and 3 labs from anyone, so I'll just hope, beyond hope, that we'll see some of those soon.
Come back.
Okay.
It has been rsync, or at WinSCP, does it work?
I'll look later. We are sort of getting towards the end of this semester, and we are sort of looking at, actually we should probably wander down to the lecture theatre, I think, just in case we have drop-ins into the lobby, so we'll do that. Alrighty, so we are looking at various bits and pieces today. We're going to cover the information in Module 9, I believe it is, that deals with Ethernet. Let me just double check that. Yes, it's Module 9. We did Module 8 last week, which was the physical layer, and we talked about the various types of media, and we talked about the bits on the media, and handy keyboard shortcut Alt-U will take you to the tree view, in case you didn't want to tab your way back there. Apparently that's been in Ventrilo since forever. I didn't know about that. Okay.
Sorry, is it any little bit better? Not at all.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Could use more though.
No, not really. It's really, really quiet. If you're using an internal microphone, you want to have the microphone slider at 100% and then go look for boosts. I'm not sure whether you're using XP or 7, so I cannot render more specific information. Okay. The actual boost for the microphone is on the playback side, so you've got to go SND Vol 32, make sure Advanced Controls is checked, pull down the properties, select, make sure the microphone is checked on the playback side, and then there'll be an Advance button next to the microphone, and that is where the actual boost is, and that'll be on the Realtek High Definition output. Don't ask me why the boost is on the playback side, it just is. Okay, so in this chapter we're basically going to talk about the OSI reference model layers 1 and 2, which are the standards for Ethernet. And Ethernet primarily concerns itself with layers 1 and 2. Because if you think of layer 3, you're starting to look at TCP, you're starting to look at IP, you're starting to look at UDP, and all of that sort of good stuff. So we will certainly concentrate on those two layers. Now the original Ethernet standard was done in 1980. It was called the DIX standard because it was done by Digital Equipment, Intel, and Xerox. And I don't think it's called that anymore because it probably makes the students laugh too hard. In 1985, however, IEEE standardized 802.3, and they made a couple of changes to the DIX standard. Basically, they changed the length field to be a length slash type field, and they made another couple of changes so you could carry different protocols on the same Ethernet, because we used to have a problem where Ethernet, a lot of network cards back in the old days could only do one protocol at a time on the wire. So you talked TCP/IP, you talked IPX/SPX, you didn't talk both. And if anybody remembers the bad old days of Novell 2, you actually used to link in these object modules, so they were .obj files that you'd actually link into the NetWare binary that came from your network manufacturer, and you'd link this together, and that would actually embed the drivers into the network operating system. Let me assure you, horrible kludge. Okay, sorry, did somebody want to say something? Or am I imagining things? How loud am I to you guys? Because I'm either going to decrease sensitivity
or
up
fine.
My microphone a smidge.
Yeah, you're good. You could, yeah.
Yeah, we have no trouble. I hear you. Fine.
And I hear you now too. Which is even better. Alrighty, here we go. I've just dropped the sensitivity a bit lower. Oh, now the other thing I was going to mention to everybody, we did a demo on Image for Windows last week, and that's now up on the server as previously announced. I came across a thing last night called Drive Snapshot, which is $10 cheaper, and it's kind of cool. So anybody who's interested in this cloning sort of stuff, Drive Snapshot is worth a look. I think it's on drivesnapshot.de, but I just mentioned that for interest. Okay, now the data link layer, as far as Ethernet is concerned, is subdivided into the logical link control layer, which is... Hang on. Why is my braille display saying 802.2? Hang on. I don't know why that's laid out like that. Okay, the LLC is 802.2, and the MAC, which is Media Access Control, is 802.3. And they are responsible for different things, as we will discuss in a moment. So you've got physical layer protocols, and you've got data link protocols, which the data link protocols are designed to deal with contention, and they're also designed to deal with getting the frames onto the wire and things like frame check sequences and all of those sorts of things. Okay, so layer one is the physical cables, the voltages on the wires, etc. And the MAC sublayer handles physical components. So, depending on what sort of transceivers you're using on Ethernet, whether you're using coaxial, whether you're using 10BASE-T, 100BASE-T, 1000BASE-T, that stuff is the media access control, and the actual MAC stuff is handled there for that sort of thing, and the actual chips and stuff change. Now, most of the time, LLC remains the same across most of the media. So, I think there is only one exception. They do something in gigabit, which is a bit odd. Now, layer one, it can't communicate with upper layers. So, when you're talking about bits and things, that's all you see on layer one, bits and voltages and the actual physical media. It cannot identify devices. There is no way for layer 1 to know which station is transmitting or which station is receiving. It only recognizes streams of bits. It can't decide which of multiple devices is transmitting if more than one device is transmitting at the same time. Any questions on any of that so far? This is really dry stuff, but sadly it's really important. Okay, so at layer 2... it connects to logical layers via the LLC. So it's actually the LLC that talks to the upper layer. So the LLC talks to layer 3, and then the MAC talks to the LLC. It uses addressing schemes to identify devices. Can anybody tell me how does an Ethernet network or type into chat, because it's only a little thing to type? What does the... Ethernet used to differentiate between various stations, I should say. Anybody?
No idea.
Would you believe the MAC address?
Oh! Duh. I was thinking some kind of something that was sent between them or something, and I'm like, I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Oh. Okay, so the fact that every like station has a unique MAC address, and when the packets go out from the source MAC address, it actually says which station it is, but that certainly wouldn't be the thing that would identify which. Okay. So that is the addressing scheme that is used to identify devices. As we've spoken about previously, the MAC address is 48 bits long. The first 24 bits is the organizational unique identifier, and the second 24 bits is a number that is specific to a particular station. So if you are doing security work, and in fact if you're using SMSniff, which there is a JAWS script for, that will get you back into the list view and stuff. I now have JAWS scripts for SMSniff. You can actually see the manufacturers of the network cards as they transmit, and that will show up in the list view thingy. So I'll try and put those scripts up on QCAT later today. Okay, so the other things that this layer 2 does is it uses frames to organize bits into groups, so that's a way of seeing where various transmissions start and stop. It uses media access control to identify transmission sources. Okay, we've already covered that. So the 802.3 is the physical stuff, and the 802.2 is the logical link controls, or the MAC and the physical, I should say. LLC functions include making the connections with the upper layers, framing the network layer packet, identifying the network layer protocol, so TCP, IP, NetBUI, IPX, SPX, DECnet, all that sort of thing. It remains relatively independent of the physical equipment. You've got examples of physical media here. These are in your notes. 10 base 5, 500 meters maximum length, 50 ohm coax, N-type connector, so thick coax basically. 10 base 2, 185 meters, a BNC connector, and not very often used. 10 base T, RJ45 connectors, which are like the big telephone things with the retaining latch on the end, or the Tunker, as my ex-wife used to call them, because that was the noise that it would sort of make as you pushed it into the socket, hopefully, unless you'd broken it. 100 base TX, it's 100 meters as well, RJ45. There's 1000 base CX, which is a maximum of 25 meters. It says 150 ohm STP mini DB9. I have never seen that. That's odd. 1000 base CX, it reckons 25 meters maximum distance, 150 ohm STP mini DB9. Oh, okay, it's server to server. It's copper based server to server stuff, I'm told. And yeah, apparently it does do that. So that's just an example that. Very rare, I don't think you see very much of it. These days in the gigabit networking, you'd probably just run a 1000 base T twisted pair cable between them, or two of them. Okay, so 1000 base T, it can be a maximum of 100 meters. And then you've got 1000 base ST, which is 200 to 500 meters multimode fiber. I can't spell fiber, and it's a subscriber connector. And then you've actually got 1000 base LX, which is 550 to 5000 meter multimode or single mode fiber. So they're the sorts of media you can run Ethernet over. That's not an exhaustive list, but that's a pretty good one. Okay, the MAC layer encapsulates data. And the data encapsulation provides three primary functions. It delimits the frames, so how do you tell where one frame starts and stops, and the next frame begins? The addressing, so your MAC addresses and that sort of thing, and your broadcast and that sort of stuff. Error detection. Now, Note on Ethernet, there isn't any error correction, but there is error detection. So you do know when a frame goes bad, but it is up to the upper layer protocols to actually retransmit that, rather than Ethernet itself. Framing shows where frames start and end. Also, MAC addresses or hardware addresses are added to the frames. Now, if the CRC is put at the end of the frame, if the CRC matches when the receiver gets the packet, there is a high probability that the packet is okay. It's a pretty high probability. It is possible for things to sneak through, but it doesn't happen very often. Ethernet is popular, and a few of the reasons for its popularity: simplicity and ease of maintenance. I suppose that's relative, but it's certainly easier than a lot of other technologies that you're likely to play with. Ability to incorporate new technologies. Reliability. Low cost of installation and upgrade. I don't know, does anybody remember when switches used to be like $200 and $300 a throw, and all of your network cards were like $50 to $100 each, and everybody was so poor that we only had like two network cards and a crossover cable because nobody could afford a switch? They were just incredibly expensive. Obviously things have come down since then, and you can get cards for, you know, $7 or $8, $11, $15. Switches, $40, $50. Most home routers have switches in them, and in fact some of the modern home routers are actually putting gigabit switches in their little all-in-one modems. There are some high-end Linksys that do it, Asus are doing it, and a few other manufacturers are doing it. Now, it's saying that frames remain the same over all types of physical Ethernet, copper, fiber, etc. Now, this whole Ethernet thing was originally based on a system called Aloha, which was a system in the Hawaiian Islands, I think it was in 1971, where they were using half-duplex radio transmitters to keep in touch between all of the islands. Basically, the system would listen for some silence. It would then attempt to transmit. If the attempt to transmit resulted in two stations transmitting at the same time, they would back off for a random amount of time and retry the transmission. This is known as carrier sense multiple access with collision detection. I think we mentioned it because everybody likes to talk about Hawaii. Although, ironically enough, they do not grow pineapple in Hawaii anymore. The original Ethernet used a shared bus topology, and it also used thick and thin coaxial cables, which we've already spoken about. What am I on? Physical bus became a problem, however, because as the number of devices increased, you had a greater chance of collision. And we had a system back in our TAFE where all of the machines were wired together with coax, and if somebody was playing the Betty Boo AVI across the network, it would cause the network to become saturated and none of the other machines could actually send and receive packets, because every time they tried there would be a collision. Has anybody here used 10 megabit Ethernet? Is anybody old enough to have used that other than me?
Yeah, I have a fairly extensive way. I remember setting up whole offices, and we had 20 stations with two switches and a huge 150-foot piece of coax between the two sort of segments across the boardroom. It was slow, but it worked.
Absolutely. And the fact that, I mean, I think it would be fair to say that the ability to network computers together has revolutionized the way data is transferred and shared and interchanged. I mean, if you think about it, there wouldn't be a Dropbox if we didn't have the network infrastructure that we have today. So that's all good. And what would happen is when these number of devices increased, you would get to the point where there used to be an activity light and a collision light. And the collision light would go on whenever a collision was detected. And on a fairly lightly loaded network or a mediumly loaded network, it was often fun to turn the to watch all of the little lights on the hub flash on and off as you saw the collision and activity lights. However, when the network became loaded, the collision light would remain on for a large period of time. And when that happened, it was time to look at upgrading the network infrastructure and taking out the hubs and things and putting in switches. Now, hubs concentrate signals. They take the signal from one port and they send it out to all of the other ports. Not the port that the signal came in on, obviously. Which is similar, kind of, to how a USB hub works, sort of. Now, yeah, the thing to understand about...
Where we still have a physical star, but a logical bus, kind of, because it's all one big chunk. It's just physically split up like a star.
Have you managed to hack into my Dropbox and nick my notes, have you, Grin? My next line says, hubs make logical bus, physical star. So there you go. And what that actually means is... and what Brian's saying is that when you actually look at the way the hub is laid out, you've got sort of the hub in the middle and all the cables going out in all different sorts of directions. But because the hub actually doesn't do anything about limiting the amount of contention, it actually looks like a physical bus. If you send a packet from one station to another station through a hub, all stations on the network see those packets, so therefore it is a physical bus. And no, Brian doesn't have my notes, I'm just joking. Okay, as collisions increase, performance drops, which is why switches were introduced to limit the effect of collisions. Alright, now a switch is a device that is somewhat smarter than a hub. And what a switch does is it... I just mixed tenses in the one sentence, naughty me. A switch basically builds a table of MAC addresses. And the table is called a CAM table, or constant address memory table. And the table basically, as machines send packets, the switch looks at which machines are on which port, and it then actually builds a table that says, you know, workstations A, B, C, and D are on port 1, and E, F, G, and H are on port 2, and all that sort of stuff. And when packets go from, say, workstation A to B, it knows that because they're on the same port, that that's going to be handed by something else, so it doesn't do anything with them. But if there's a packet going from A to E, then it's going to have to send stuff from port 1 to port 2. Okay, but question. If a switch does not have an entry in its CAM table for a particular workstation, where will the packet be sent?
Broadcast address for the network?
It would be sent to all of the ports. So if you are sending a frame to MAC address 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the switch doesn't have an entry for that, it is going to flood that frame onto all ports until 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 responds, whereupon the switch can then open up a micro segment between the source and the destination because it doesn't yet know where 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 will be. Does anybody have any questions with that? Because yes, there are questions in your tests about this. Obviously, it goes without saying that that the broadcast packets, such as the who has sent out all ports of the switch. However, it is worth noting that if anybody who's watched TCP dump on a switch, and there is a remote bundle, so you guys should possibly look at this. I might try and whip up a lab where you actually watch this. You will see all the ARP who has's go out, but you will only see the ARP replies for the machine that you're currently sitting on, because everything else doesn't forward those packets to that particular port that you're sitting on. So you'll see the ARP who has's for everyone, but you'll only see the replies if your machine sends one, or for any other machines that are on sort of a hub-based topology. There are actually intelligent switches where you can turn a port into a monitoring port, and you can tell a machine to forward all of the packets to this particular port from, say, ports 1, 2, 3, and 4 out to, say, port 7, and that's one way you can watch what traffic is traveling on the network. However, there is a potential problem with this. If you forward all of the traffic from ports 1, 2, 3, 4 out to port 7, and ports 1, 2, and 3, 4 are fairly busy, it is possible to generate more traffic than it is possible to send over port 7 in a particular time period. Anybody got any questions on any of that? Any comments, things that they'd like to add?
So when switches come online, you know, initially when you first sort of power them up, because most of them don't keep their ARP table, they're suspected non-volatile RAM, do they just send out ARP who is requests on all their ports to sort of get started, or is there a different way of dealing with that?
No, the switch doesn't send out anything. The switch just waits for machines to communicate. And as you would probably know, if you are sending packets on an Ethernet, the first thing that happens usually from a host, unless it already knows something, is that it sends out an ARP who has for a particular machine, and the switch sees that packet go out, and it looks at the source MAC address of that port, and it then tags it on the particular port that that packet went out. And then when the ARP reply comes back, it looks from where the ARP reply came from, and it tags the MAC address of where it came from. So it's once you send out an ARP who has, and you get an ARP reply, you've added two entries to the switch table. If you already knew the MAC address, then as soon as a machine transmits, and it transmits from its source MAC address to a destination MAC address, the switch adds the source address to its table. And when the destination host replies, it adds the other MAC address. Actually, that's an interesting question, actually, Ian. If a switch sends a packet out to a destination MAC address, it doesn't add the destination MAC address to the table until the destination replies, does it?
No, it does.
Does it? Unless it sends it out all ports. Yeah, that's what I thought. The switches only work on the source address. I was just clarifying that. Yep. So when they're making their table, they only look at the source MAC addresses. So as each machine fires up on the network and starts sending things, I mean, you think about it. You turn on a workstation, like a Windows workstation. First packet out is usually a DHCP discover packet. And as soon as that packet goes out, the switch can look at the source MAC address and say, this is on such and such a port. So that's how the switch bootstraps itself. It all happens very quickly and very seamlessly, I must say. And then it forgets it after a while. I don't know how long it keeps it around for, but... Okay. Some switches just turf them out after 30 minutes or whatever. If it doesn't see anything from those stations, some switches, probably the ones that you pay lots of money for, you can customize that sort of thing. But they're the expensive ones. Does that cover that, Brian? Does that make sense now?
Yeah, it does.
Alrighty. Modern installations use 1 gigabit Ethernet, and they're saying that you can put Ethernet into metropolitan networks using fiber. Didn't they do a fiber trial in Tasmania or something? Do you remember that?
The
NBN. Yeah, parts of Tasmania, if you're on the right bit of hill, you can get some NBN, which is our national broadband network. That's our government's initiative to give everybody fast internet at affordable prices. And... to give everybody network access. Sorry, I shouldn't have said the second bit. And nobody knows how it's going to work, and nobody knows who's going to police it, and we've got a pretty good idea as to who's actually going to try and build it, but they're not sure how they're going to build it because the government hasn't told them yet, is about my sum up of the National Broadband Network. Okay, so both the Ethernet 2 and the IEEE 802.3 standards define the minimum frame length as 64 bytes and the maximum of 1,516. What's that say? My braille display's got a dead dot right on that cell. 1518 bytes. This includes the bytes from the destination MAC address through to the frame check sequence. The preamble, which is basically 62 bits of 01010101 all the way up to 2 bits of 11, which is used for synchronizing the transmitter and receiver, are not included in the byte count. So the IEEE 802.3 AC standard, which took the frame to 1,522 bytes, and that was enhanced to allow VLANs to be put in. Now, has anybody played with VLANs much?
I've tried, but I've never gotten them to work just right, and I think it's the actual chip in my router, because I was doing it with a router with sort of third-party firmware, and I think it didn't implement properly because it never quite worked.
Yeah, there was actually two different chips, and if you had the Broadcom something 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 something, it didn't do the VLAN stuff. But if you actually had the ADM6996 chip, it did. And there was actually a firmware revision of the 54GS. The 1.0s did them and the 1.1s didn't or something. It was all a bit odd. Basically, the idea of VLANs is the ability to have multiple local area networks on the same wiring, and you define what stuff is going to travel over which network by setting the VLAN ID. And using your switching infrastructure, you can control which bits of cable and wires and stuff, see which bits of VLAN stuff. Okay, so I have a note here that says that the destination MAC address comes first, so that switches and things can key on it. So they want to know where the packet's going before they know where the packet is coming from. Now, there are actually a number of types of switching. One is called store and forward, which is what you get in most of your cheap switches. It receives the entire packet, it looks at it, it then forwards it onto the other port. This does introduce latency. There is cut-through switching, which is quite expensive, which is where it reads up to the end of the destination MAC address and then it immediately opens the circuit to the other port as soon as it's got the destination MAC address. And then there's fragment free, which, if my memory serves me correctly, does the first 64 bytes of the packet. Checks if the CRC on the head is okay, it sends it on. That would have been a trip to Wikipedia if I wasn't sure about that one. After that, you've got the length slash type field. If the value is less than 1500, if it's greater than 1536, it shows the protocol type. If it has CRC error on receive, it drops the packet. Electrical interference, that sort of stuff can cause the CRC, the packet to be corrupted, and it will be dropped. Now, a unicast frame goes to a particular MAC address on the network. So if you're communicating from 192.168.1.1 to 192.168.1.7, once you've done the ARP backwards and forwards to find out what the MAC address of 192.168.1.7, the packet goes directly to the MAC address of that host. The broadcast MAC address is 48 ones, so that's 6 lots of 0xFF. If you want to send something that to a non-specific network broadcast, you send it to 255.255.255.255, and you use this for when you're doing DHCP discover messages. I don't know whether anybody remembers the bad old days when you actually had to add a route of 255.255.255.255 pointing through your local Ethernet interface, otherwise the DHCP client under Linux wouldn't work. Okay, now this is all a bit complicated, but I'll just mention it because it's in the notes. I don't think we're tested on it. The multicast MAC address is a special value that begins with 0100 5e in hexadecimal. The value ends the lower 23 bits of the IP multicast group address, and then into the remaining 6 hexadecimal characters of the Ethernet MAC address. So it's basically this hash mess, so that the cards can look for a specific pattern on a multicast group and then figure out what card it's coming from then. And then the remaining bit is always set to 1. A 0, I should say. I always found that mind-bogglingly complicated. The only thing I've ever used multicasting for is ghosting, like, multiple labs full of machines. It is used for other things, but it's not that common. Do I need to talk any more about CSMACD, or are we all pretty happy with that?
Pretty happy with it.
Anyone else confused about CSMACD? Okay, right, good. A hub is known as a multiport repeater, because it obviously takes the signal from one port and repeats it to all of the other ports. Now, hubs and repeaters increase the size of a collision domain. This is not cool. Good luck getting a hub today. You still can, but they're pretty rare and they're only used in special purpose scenarios. When hubs are connected together, they create an extended star. Now, as distances get longer, the latency increases and the devices need to listen for longer to look for collisions, and this is why there is a distance limit on Ethernet. The bit times on 10 megabit Ethernet are 100 nanoseconds. So definitely not time to get a coffee while that happens. As the megabits go up, the nanoseconds go down. So, for example, on 100 megabit Ethernet, you're looking at 10 nanoseconds. And then things just get quicker and quicker from then on. You can't have half duplex in 10 gigabit Ethernet. And the slot time is the time between the... No, that's the interframe spacing. Done myself in with my own notes here.
Isn't it the time it takes for, like, a packet to go the length of the media or something like that?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I know that devices must wait 96 bit times between frames, and that is known as the interframe spacing. Let me just open up a copy of Google here. Go to homepage, thank you. Go up here, Ethernet slot time. Oh, and I didn't put anything in my search field. That's not so cool. Anyone seen that, where you type something into Google and Jaws decides it's not actually putting it into the field for you.
Yeah.
Do you have IE-9?
No, thankfully.
Is Google Instant?
It might be.
I use IE-9 and I don't have too many problems with it. I've always had Google sometimes decide it's not going to type in for some reason. It doesn't happen too.
I think there's this thing that says if you're using a screen reader, you can turn off Google Instant, and also turning off suggest search query stuff in the search box is a good idea. Okay. Ah, here we are. Wikipedia has an entry on slot time. And it's only relevant for CSMA CD networks. So we... No, I don't want to jump there. Okay, it's a concept in computer networking. It is twice the time it takes for an electronic pulse, OSI, layer 1 physical, to travel the length of the maximum theoretical distance between nodes. So you are 100% correct. Well done, Randy. Wikipedia agrees with you. So that is the slot time. And the slot time... and they wait a minimum of the slot time before transmitting to make sure that the bits can travel all the way to the end of the network, or the longest segment, so that you can actually detect a collision. So you actually have to sort of transmit and wait the slot time so that you can actually ascertain whether... Thank you. There has been a collision on the media. And they mention that because it can slow things down to a degree, although it's somewhat necessary, so they do it. And if you actually use the slot time to wait for the message to get from one end of the network to the other, you get a local collision which is detected, rather than a late collision which is not detected and makes a mess of packets on the wire. So there you go, people. If you ever forget quite what slot time is, Wikipedia's article is excellent. Have fun. Now, the slot time changes depending on the speed of the network, and there's a nifty table here. Time interval. 10 megabits per second, 512 bit times, and that's 51.2 microseconds. At 100 megabits per second, 512 bit times, 5.12 microseconds, and at 1 gigabit per second, 4096 bit times, 4.096 microseconds, and so on. And you don't use it at 10 gigabits per second, apparently. Now, it's only relevant if you're using half duplex, because you don't need to listen for collisions if you are doing full duplex, because you can send and receive at the same time. So we only use slot time for half duplex transmissions. Thank you, Wikipedia. Anybody got any questions on any of that so far?
Can I go back to switches for a sec? Because something occurred to me and I don't know if it's even relevant anymore. I remember buying switches a long time ago, and they had specific uplink ports. Now, maybe that is just simple and it predates the auto detection of your cable type, where you had crossover and straight cable, and that was all it did, but maybe there was more to it.
Basically, before they had... Back when we used 10 megabit Ethernet, I don't believe the earlier 10 megabit Ethernet used the auto N-way negotiation. Now, the auto N-way negotiation is a thing that encodes your speed and duplex settings in what we call the pre-link pulse, which is fairly complex and we don't really mess with it. But basically what it boils down to is, back in the day, if you wanted to link two switches together, you actually had a port on the end that had its transmit and receive pairs crossed over. So, say for example, And sometimes this is something you actually had to watch out for, because some switches, say for example there were 8-port switches, they would have 8 ports on them, and then there was a little button on the end, and if you pressed the button it would cross over like port 8's transmit and receive wires. And so what you'd do is, if you were linking two switches together, you'd run a straight through cable from port 8 of the switch with the button pushed in to another switch, preferably to a port that didn't have the button pushed in, and that would actually cross the transmit and receive pairs to link the two switches together. Or if you didn't have one of those buttons to actually cross the cross-link ports across, you actually had to connect switches together with crossover cables. So the idea of the actual uplink port was to allow straight-through cables to be used all the way through your network, but to actually have the switch be responsible for switching the pairs rather than the cable. Maybe that'll demystify it a bit.
Yeah, just all the ones I've had recently are auto-sensing, so you could use whatever cable, but maybe back in the day, because I'm talking, 97, 98,
Oh, yeah, I had an HP switch, and it had, they gave me I was really excited about it, I was doing some work for an ISP, and they gave me a 10 megabit per second 8-port HP switch, and I was stoked. Whopping big plug pack. You could have, you know, stopped a thief from breaking in by hurling this thing at them, and this 8-port switch, and on the end it had this button that would turn port 8 either into a crossover port or a regular port. And that was certainly part of the, personally, it's, you know, part of a lot of switches that you tend to see. But most of the stuff is auto-sensing, and a lot of PC network cards are auto-sensing. I don't know whether anybody's been into the BIOS of a modern PC with a sighted person, but a lot of the modern BIOSes actually have network diagnostics where you can actually check whether your cable's any good. Has anybody played with that?
Didn't know it had it.
Okay, yeah, some of them do. I don't know whether you can do similar tests under Linux. I should actually have a Google around and see if there are tools for actually running the tests. But some of the network cards, especially the VIA ones, and some of the Realtek and some of the are actually capable of doing link tests and that sort of thing. The thing you've got to understand, though, is when you're connecting two computers together with a cable, you can almost be guaranteed that if it's 5 minutes before a presentation and you've got a deadline, that one of the computers or the computers in question will not have auto crossover, and you'll have to go and chase the building down for a crossover cable. So watch out for that. Now, in the late 90s, 100 megabit Ethernet was standardized. I actually remember that. I remember in 1995 and 1996, they were arguing about whether VG AnyLAN or 100 base T was going to become the standard. And I think it turned out to be 100 base T, but VG AnyLAN was the technology that was being run and promoted by HP at the time, if my memory serves. And it was one of the competitors to 100 base T. There's all sorts of nasty tricks that are pulled to make gigabit Ethernet work. Just read your notes, it's mind-boggling. Now, hubs and switches. Hubs force media to be shared, as I've already discussed. The more hubs you add, the more chance there is of a late collision. So we're talking about the 3-4-5 rule. Three repeaters, four segments, maximum... No, hang on. Let me get this right. Five segments, four repeaters, and three segments that contain stations. Now, luckily you don't need to know the 3-4-5 rule anymore because we don't tend to use much hubs, but daisy chaining hubs and things together will add latency. Also, so will daisy chaining switches. Now, to be honest, if you're on a home network and the latency goes from 1 millisecond to 2 milliseconds, or it goes from 1 millisecond to 3 milliseconds, you're probably not going to notice much. But it's worth noting that if you daisy chain 7 switches together and one of the switches is crummy, you're going to find that the speed of the network will be impacted. And I actually discovered that when I had some Netgear gigabit switches, they were okay, but when I pulled out the network, Netgear switches and put in the Linksys ones with the management interface, things were a lot faster and traffic travelled over my network, provided I wasn't copying with Windows 7, as previously discussed. Actually, here's a question for you, Brian. Have you done network printing with Windows 7 and Samba? Because mine doesn't work. Here. There you go.
Yes, actually. Oh, wait a minute. No, my Jet Direct card doesn't use Samba. It uses its own weird thingy. No, I haven't tried it, but I will.
Okay, mine's broken. And you print with XP, and it just goes like a mad thing. And you print with Windows 7, and it doesn't. So, don't know. Still looking into that one.
Now, I mean, I'm sending to my Jet Direct card, I'm sending just basically to LPD. But I don't think that uses Samba. It uses a weird proprietary protocol, I think.
Yeah, it just uses this raw socket printing. It just sort of opens up the socket to the printer and dumps like a whole print job out in port 9100, and then the printer deals with it. So we'll have to do some more playing with that. But Vista and 7 refuse to print to my printer under Windows 7, and there's got to be a solution, because I refuse to believe that I'm the only person who's had this problem. There must be hundreds of people out there that have had this problem, so a bit more Google for I think. Now, as we spoke about the switch micro segments the network, and it reduces collisions because it splits the network up into send receive bits and pieces, and that is how it avoids the collision. Now, the switches improve the network because there's dedicated bandwidth to each port. You can theoretically, if you've got a gigabit switch, you can have a gigabit of stuff traveling on that particular port. So if you've got a good switch, you can have a gigabit per second going between two ports on the switch, and a gigabit per second going between two other ports on the switch. And provided those transfers are separate, they will operate independently. A collision-free environment. And you've usually got full duplex, so you don't get any collisions, so that doesn't slow any of that sort of thing down. Full duplex operation, which means things can send and receive at the same time. Already covered that. And that are the notes. Anybody got any questions and queries on Ethernet-y-like stuff? Alrighty, I'll press stop.